faith-filled finance. All major UK bank accounts. One app. Provision is built by Christians to help you steward what God's given you. Track your spending, saving and giving in one place. Join the waitlist now at provision.money and get your first month free. That's provision.money.
Premier Podcast.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. This is the show where we delve into a person's life, faith and ministry, and it's brought to you in association with the UK's leading Christian magazine, Premier Christianity. If you would like a free sample copy of our latest issue, then you can head to our website, premierchristianity.com/free sample. I'm Sam Hales, editor of that magazine, and I'm pleased to say that today, right here on The Profile, I'm speaking to Tim Jupp. He was the keyboard player in one of the biggest Christian bands of all time, Delirious, and today he's the founder and pioneer of the Big Church Day Out Festival. That's an annual event which attracts thousands of people every year. Really looking forward to talking about both Delirious and the Big Church Day Out on the show today. Welcome along, Tim.
Hello, Sam. It's great to be with you.
So let's go right back to the beginning, as we always do on this show. We'd love to hear about a person's early life. So tell me a bit about growing up and where Christian faith came in for you.
So I grew up in a Christian home on the south coast of England with Christian parents, and was probably one of those kids who became a Christian most years. You know, you keep recommitting your life to Jesus kind of thing. And got married at the age of 24. I worked when I left school with someone who you are far too young to remember, called Ishmael, who did children's stuff. I mean, I did that for like 12 years. Then jumping forward, I owned a studio in Littlehampton, where I still live. It's a little one-horse seaside town on the south coast. And we used to make lots of the UK Christian worship albums. People like Matt Redman's first record and Noel Richards and Graham Kendrick. We used to make records for them there. And then we started a youth event in the early 90s called Cutting Edge, which was like 30 kids in a school classroom first time we met. And it quickly grew. And after about 3 years, we had three events along the south coast of England in Southampton, Portsmouth and Littlehampton, our hometown. We had over 3,000 young people gathering every month just to worship. And that was in the early 90s.
Wow.
And that really, and Delirious was the house band for that youth worship event, and it kind of went from there, really.
Amazing. So it sounds like music was a really key part of your life right from the get-go. Where do you think that influence came in?
Well, it came in, I think, when I moved to a town called Worthing when I was about 14 years old, and I went to this church, and they had this really old semi-pro jazz piano player, and he just really inspired me.
Right.
And I thought, oh, I'd love to do that. And because I can remember one thing he always said to me was, don't give me the music, it winds me up. So he was a guy who used to sit at the piano playing away, you know, just by ear. And I thought, oh, this is amazing, because this is like one incredible inspiration. So I kind of picked up the piano those days, failed my education miserably because I used to bunk off school and my A-level courses and go and sit in the piano, at the piano, they had this Steinway piano in the church that I was part of. And I used to go there during the daytime when no one was around. And learned to play basically Christian worship songs. Well, there weren't that many in those days, but that's how it all began, really.
Amazing. So I guess it wasn't just music, it was actually kind of Christian music right from the very beginnings of even learning to play an instrument.
I think I fell in love with worship really, really, really early on. I remember my parents taking me to Spring Harvest when I was probably about 12 years old and walking into that big top thing with thousands of people. And I think back in those days, Spring Harvest was probably the only event where you could kind of go and get that experience where the worship was contemporary. I mean, that was one of the first places you ever went to where they had what we now call a time of worship, you know, when they strung one song onto the next one without stopping for the notices or a reading or talk in between. And they would have a continuous flow of worship, and I thought, well, that was really exciting. I think from an early age, I thought, that's just what I want to do with my life.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you kind of almost became a Christian every year, you know, one of those kids, and I think a lot of people can identify with that. If you grow up in a Christian home and there's opportunities to give your life to God or to become a Christian. Since then, though, has there been any kind of major moments of doubt or anything you call a crisis of faith since the early years?
No, I think I've never had really major moments of doubt, but we go through life with questions, don't we? And I think that doesn't go away. And I think the older I get now I'm over 50, it's almost more questions. In a sense, you get older and you realise some ways the older you get, the less you know about anything. And, you know, and I think in the early days when you're younger, you ask questions and you're probably a little bit more black and white and you want answers and you think there's an answer to everything. And maybe life's a little bit greyer than we ever thought once we get old and we realise it's never quite as simple as black and white.
It's interesting. I've heard a lot of people say that, actually, that as you get older, you realise less and less things in the world are black and white. And even with theology, people can sometimes become more comfortable with the grey areas, just become more comfortable with, actually, I'm not going to completely understand that element of God or my faith or whatever. But, you know, you spend a lot of time with Christian leaders, church leaders. Do you think there's sometimes a reluctance of those in some form of ministry or leadership to sometimes voice those doubts or concerns because they're worried about how that might affect those who are following them?
Yeah, I think they're in a difficult position. My wife herself leads a church, and people do often want to know what your position is on things. And as soon as you make positions on things, you know, you can't be everyone's friend in that sense, because people say, well, I agree with you or don't agree with you. And I think life often is about not actually being so positional about everything, but how we learn to hold everything in tension, you know, because it's not as straightforward, is it, all the time, saying this person's right and that person's wrong. And often we make ourselves right by trying to make others wrong too, which isn't always a helpful thing either.
So picking up the story then, you've already taken us all the way through very quickly and efficiently. I was amazed.
That's my media training from years ago.
From early life all the way up to Delirious, we got the snapshot picture, which was great. You took us all the way up to Cutting Edge, and I guess we kind of got to that moment in your story where a big decision was made, and I don't think you can underestimate the weight of this decision for a group of guys, as you were in what became Delirious, to decide to go full-time really with Christian music, and to say, we're going to support our families, we're going to try and make a living from writing, recording, touring. That was a huge moment, surely. What do you think of that time, looking back?
That was a massive moment for us. I think if you put it in context, back in that time, it was kind of mid-90s. There weren't really any other full-time Christian bands, and historically we hadn't really had any. Maybe there'd been one or two, and often they were kind of missionary-funded, as, you know, musical missionaries, really. And I think to give your jobs up, and some of us had young children and that kind of thing, was actually a huge thing. I can remember someone phoning me, you know, saying, oh, I heard the great news that you guys are going full-time, now what are you going to do for a living? And it was kind of like, well, no, I've just said we're going to go full-time, but we understand that, but you've got to do something that kind of puts food on the table. You can't just do that. And so, no, we kind of really did decide to do that. And I think with Delirious, I mean, from beginning to end, it's like 17 years altogether. We didn't ever have a plan B. It was just plan A the whole time. And so we kind of threw our lot in, went for it. I mean, it was an amazing time, because similarly, there weren't many other full-time Christian bands, but also because there weren't many others, there was a kind of a good space when, you know, we were writing some songs and they were starting to get out in the church. And we're kind of a weird beginning where I think where lots of bands start and then they travel around and start to play at places so that people become familiar with their music and that kind of thing. Well, we kind of had a back to front journey with that, where our songs went somewhere before we ever got there. And I can remember the first time turning up at places and we'd never been there, and it felt like everybody knew your songs. So that was an amazing thing. We kind of followed on the coattails of our songs as they went around the UK and later on around the world and went around and were able to play them live with people.
And what was your kind of role in the band? Obviously, you're playing keyboards, but sometimes in bands people say, well, they're the main songwriter, or they do a lot of the arranging, or this person actually comes up with a lot of the production ideas or the particular sounds we use on a track, or this person is more behind the scenes with admin. Did you find yourself sort of fitting into a role like that within the band?
Yeah, I did, very much so. I think in the early days I was really, well, all the way through, I was very involved in the kind of back-end business side of what we did. I think, you know, the minute you start selling one CD to someone and there's some sort of revenue, then you've got a business and you've got to work out how that goes. And I think
a lot of bands starting out, they kind of miss this, don't they? They don't always understand you're going to have to effectively run this as a business. And if you don't, then you could find yourself in some trouble. So yeah, you kind of took that on board quite early.
You know, I think a lot of, you know, there's not a right and wrong all this. And a lot of bands sign everything away they do to record companies, right, all this kind of thing. And a lot of those people take care of that kind of side of life for them. But then you give away control as well. And we felt in our team, we wanted to really stay, you know, as captain of the ship and to be able to steer the vision God had given us. Yeah. And so we never did that.
Right.
We never kind of signed our stuff away or gave up the rights to anything. But the other side was we then had to take care of business ourselves.
Sure.
And we ended up in the end, I think we had 25 staff in our office, about 12 guys on the road, in addition, all funded by one band of five people traveling around. So it was, you know, it was a little operation.
Yeah.
But we loved it.
Yeah. Can you give us an example of kind of what that looks like in practice to not hand things over to a label or whoever? So to retain control, what does that actually look like in practice? Is that you guys saying, oh, we're not going to, I don't know, play that event or tour that much? Or, you know, what's the concrete example and the reason why you'd want to retain control and perhaps not sign over what a lot of other bands would sign over?
I think, well, part of it was because of a vision thing. So we wanted, felt like we wanted to be free, to be blown with the wind, and we're kind of where the Holy Spirit led us, and be able to say yes to this and no to that without too many outside influences. Part of it was an economic, commercial decision that if this could work and we could sell records on our own without having to give somebody else half the income, we had a better chance of creating a sustainable way of doing this longer term. So that was part of the decision making. But I think, you know, when you do that, then when things don't work out or go quite as planned, you've only got yourself to blame, haven't you? So I think, you know, you often hear these stories of people, oh, we blame the manager, we blame the record company, all this kind of thing. Well, we were the manager of the record company, so we had to kind of work it out all in-house, you know.
So, you know, I think I mentioned at the beginning, arguably the world's biggest Christian band, certainly at the time. What are the highs and lows of being in that kind of a position, in that kind of a world?
Well, the biggest, you know, we were all family guys, and between us we had 16 children. So the biggest conversation we ever had in the band, which never went away and was there on an almost daily basis, was, you know, how much we could go away. You know, one of the downsides, if you like, or an upside to being in a band is you have to go and play. And particularly when you live in a little one-horse seaside town on the south coast of England, you can't really make a living or create a future by doing gigs in your hometown every night of the week.
Yeah.
So you end up travelling, don't you? And that's exciting in terms of the vision.
Mm-hmm.
And that could only work because all our other halves were bought into that too. But that was, you know, that was a tension, because who wants to go away all the time and leave your family at home? So that's, you know, one of the biggest things that we always talked about.
Yeah. Was that, would that kind of lead to arguments if one person was more comfortable spending more time away than others?
I don't think it led to arguments at all. But I think what happens is you're a team, and in like any team, everyone's different. And so, you know, sometimes a week away for one person in the team was just too much at whatever stage they were going through in life. And, you know, at other times someone, oh, I'm fine to go away for 2 weeks and I'm fine with that. And so you're always working out, and do you go with the lowest common denominator of the person who doesn't want to go away, or do you go away with others? So I think, and what you do in all that, you just have to learn to love each other and have grace for each other, because there's not necessarily a right or wrong in all that.
One of the craziest stories I've heard about Delirious, and possibly about any band, which I love, and I'd love to hear from you if it's true. Is it true that you guys flew to Australia for one day to play one gig and then came back again?
Yeah, totally. Oh, actually, New Zealand.
New Zealand.
Yeah, I do remember that.
That is nuts.
But we were away from home for 5 days.
Okay.
And didn't go to bed. Because it's like basically 2 days out there on the plane. And then you arrive in at New Zealand in the morning, get picked up in this van, drove 3 hours. having been on a plane for 2 days, and then we arrived at this place. We did a sound check. We played this gig. I mean, there were 25,000 people there. And then after we played, we got back in the van, taken back to the airport, sat in the airport that night, got on the plane in the morning, 2 days home, and never went to bed.
That is...
killer. I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. Terrible decision.
It must be some sort of world record. I mean, I've never heard of any other band doing that. That is something else, isn't it?
Yeah, it was very funny.
You've mentioned already the kind of the family difficulties. I think you've got 4 kids yourself. And I can imagine that being one of the most difficult things to manage. Not just for yourself, as you say. I think all the rest of the band had kids and family to look after. And... How do you kind of reflect on all that looking back? Do you think, are there any regrets, or do you think actually families were so on board, this was a mission thing, God called us to it, it's okay? Or do you think actually, well, I don't know, looking back, is there a bit of feeling uncomfortable that weren't around enough?
No, I mean, I honestly look back with no regrets on that at all. My kids are doing great. They're all grown up now and getting married, that kind of stage of life. And, you know, I think for them, you can see now that had a really positive influence on their life. I mean, you know, there were treats along the way.
Right.
It wasn't all, you know, tears and saying goodbye all the time. And there were times in our life when the family could come with us and we got to experience that together.
That's cool. Like a kind of big holiday away to another country almost.
So they kind of look back with amazing memories on it all, and no regrets in that. I think the main thing is, you know, I think for all of us, you know, we're called to be obedient, aren't we? And I think for us, we felt that's what God was leading us into. I think the regrets honestly would have been if we'd not done it, because I think we felt that God had put something in our hands and it was our responsibility to take that and use that. And so it was a great privilege, I would say.
Incredible. Well, tell me about the day then that it was first suggested or the conversation happened about ending it all.
Well, that was a really interesting time because we caught us off guard because we had some massive meetings, I think a week before, with a company called Live Nation, and they wanted to do a big global deal on, like, how do we recreate the next 10 years for you guys, and, you know, all this stuff that, and everybody kind of got excited about those conversations. And then kind of out of the blue, I can remember we were at some big church in America on a 10-day trip, where we were halfway through this trip. We're about half an hour before we're going to go on in front of 5,000 people. And Martin, we were wandering around this car park outside this church, and Martin said, "Oh, I've got something to share with you. I'm feeling like it's time that I call it a day." And I think we all knew straight away that probably would mean the end of Delirious. And so I can remember that because the timing was absolutely terrible. So we spent half an hour on the phone, you know, back home saying, "Oh, this is it. It's all ending. After 17 years, we're just about to go on stage." Wow. So it was a slightly awkward gig, that one, because I think we were there to do a job and people had been excited and waited weeks to come and see us and bought a ticket and all that kind of thing, and we were on stage. I don't think anyone had their mind on what was going on in the room much that night.
Wow. And so then, I mean, I guess this kind of time is almost where the Big Churched Out story kind of comes in, doesn't it? Because the very first Big Churched Out festival, Delirious headlined.
Yeah, in the very last year that
we were
in 2009, so it was 10 years ago.
So tell me a bit about this story. And it is an amazing story of how Big Churched Out started. Involves a family and a lot of prayer and an estate, and you guys being given permission to set up what is now a very long-running festival. And I guess this transition for you personally of going from being a keyboard player in a band to now managing a festival. So tell me a bit about that kind of shift that took place.
Well, it was an amazing thing because when I look back, in 17 years of being in Delirious, I'd never, in all honesty, had one conversation with anybody about another trajectory in life or doing anything different other than what we were doing. All our conversation, our whole life was about seeing the vision of Delirious grow and where that would go. I'd never talked to anyone. And I met this old friend of mine that I hadn't seen for years at a mutual friend's wedding. And we talked about the old days. So back in the old days, before Delirious was Delirious, and we ran this event called Cutting Edge, we used to do these events on the beach in Little Hampton, where we live. Every summer, about 10,000 people would turn up for a worship event. It was great fun, and people got saved, and we baptised them in the sea and all that kind of thing. And that was brilliant. And this friend of mine had been part of that story. And we just got dreaming about, he's saying, wouldn't it be amazing if we could do something where we live again that brought the church together as a kind of celebration thing? And he said, you should go and see this friend of mine who owns this estate. And I'm thinking, well, I haven't really got time to get involved in something. The band's full on.
Right, yeah.
You know, life's busy there. And, you know, I was managing the band and playing in the band. And we were away most weekends at some corner of the earth or other. So we were busy doing that. So I said, well, I'll go and see your friend. So I rock up at this amazing country estate, meet this wonderful man called Harry. And the amazing thing is I was with Harry last night having dinner with him and his wife on the estate. And they've become really two of our dearest friends over the last 10 years. And we see that a lot of them. And I'd never met this man before. And I'd lived 15 minutes away from him for most of my life. And there was this huge posh house. And he was like the poshest guy I'd ever met. Real kind of, you know, old aristocracy and landed gentry. And his kind of his jumper was full of holes. And but beautiful, amazing country house. And he obviously had been set up by my friend as well. So I walked in and he said, the first thing he said to me, he said, hello. He says, hello, are there going to be tents for this thing? So he obviously thinks I'm going to come along, run some event. I'm thinking, oh, no, you think I want to come and do something like Glastonbury and trash your estate. I think this conversation is going to go nowhere. We're both here in a slightly awkward place because a friend, almost like a blind date, set us up. So I just threw the question back at him and I said, well, what would you think, Harry, if something like this ever happened on your land? And he looked at me and he said, I'd love that.
Wow.
And he told me about all the kind of prophetic words and visions people had about seeing people gather on his land.
Incredible.
So he thinks I'm like the fairy godmother come along to help deliver this vision that they'd been given on the land. And I said, well, this sounds like a really exciting God story, and all those words you've had sound amazing and absolutely fantastic. And I said, well, I don't know what to do with this, but let's stay in touch kind of thing. Now, the amazing thing was that was 4 weeks before Martin dropped that bombshell on us in that car park about the band ending. So the first conversation I'd ever had with anyone in 17 years happened 4 weeks before the ending of the band. So when the band came to the end, I thought, oh, this is really interesting. I've had this conversation a month ago. And I went back to see Harry and we kind of talked about it more, and we talked about the vision of seeing the church gather. Because you have to remember, really, what a lot of Delirious did is that we travelled all over the world and we really helped be a part of facilitate other people's visions of seeing the church gather.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what we did. That was our job.
Yeah, so true.
It's like wherever we went, people wanted the church to gather and they'd ask us to come and be part of that and do the worship for
them. And so many of those gigs or festivals or conferences or wherever it was you were playing, so many of those were interdenominational. You know, you'd have
Methodists, absolutely.
You'd have Catholics, you'd have Protestants of various
we had done absolutely everything in Delirious on that kind of spectrum of the expression of church, pretty much, you know, from the most crazy mad sort of Pentecostal things in South America to playing with the Pope on an airfield with 1.5 million people in Germany. I mean, like, and then playing in small nightclubs, and we pretty much kind of done the whole spectrum.
Yeah.
And that's the joy of music, isn't it? One of the wonders is you can go a lot of places that the preachers can't go to, you know, where there's not quite such apparent theology to it. And people, you know, music can be a thing that gathers people rather than divides people and separates people.
Yeah.
So that's really why, you know, now doing the Big Church Day, there's a lot of similarities, and it's a lot of the DNA of Delirious in it. Because the DNA of Delirious was, we believe that when people came together and they worshipped together, that the Holy Spirit could really touch people's lives, and at the end of the day, make a massive difference to people's lives. And that's all that the Big Church Day Out is trying to do. It's saying, we're going to create a space for the whole church to come together. We expect God to be there, and let's see what he gets up to.
It's been really interesting to hear you talk in the past about church unity, because one of the things about Big Church Day Out, I mean, how many people is it now?
We're about 25,000.
25,000.
So I think we're the largest kind of single annual gathering that happens every year.
Yeah.
Because I love a lot of these big gatherings, but a lot of them, you know, people put a lot of effort into doing a big event and they seem to just happen once and never happen again.
Sure.
So I was always keen that when we do the Big Church Day Out,
yeah,
if it's going to be almost on that stadium size thing, that we create a way that we could do it every year. Because this, yeah, if this is about people bringing their friends, people getting a kind of glimpse into what it could, what church could look like, and an opportunity to find out and discover a relationship with Jesus. Well, you don't want to do that once, do you?
Sure.
You
know, no, absolutely.
You know,
not.
You want them to then bring their friends the next year.
Well, I can speak as someone who has attended this event not just once, not just twice, not three times, you know, many times. And it is the sort of place where you want to keep coming back to, for sure. As I mentioned, with church unity specifically, you've said in the past that the conversation about church unity is getting louder. I'd love to hear more about what you mean by that and the kind of heart behind Big Church Day Out as a place that can bring Christians of different denominations together in some form of unity.
Yeah, I guess, you know, one of the joys of what I do now is I get to spend more time in England. I get to connect more with people in church leadership. And then wherever you go, it feels like people are talking about it.
Right.
In a way that they never used to. And that's a really exciting thing. And I think we see that worked out on many different levels through some of the social action things that go on, where churches come together in communities and do things and that kind of thing. We see it a lot, I think, at leadership level. So there's a lot of conferences or there's other forums and places where it brings church leaders together. And I think that's absolutely essential and vital, and then we need even more of that. But when I go to those things, I kind of just come away thinking, well, that's brilliant, but what does it look like if the people came together? Who's doing that? Who's creating that space for that? And then really, so what the Big Church Day Out does, it just creates a space for all the people to come together. And I think the interesting thing about us is that then, you know, it's not owned by denomination. It's not owned by the big churches or anything like that. It just says to everyone, here's a space and we can come together.
Well, that brings us to the end of part one of my interview with Tim Jupp from the Big Church Day Out. Join us again to hear more from him right after this.
Premier Christianity Magazine. In this month's issue,
we speak with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, about praying in tongues, his vision for evangelism, and how he intends to hold the Anglican Communion together. And we ask, should Christians adopt the tidying up trend of Marie Kondo? Plus, discover why we must get better at handling God's gift of prophecy. All this and more in March's issue.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. I'm the editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. That is the publication that sponsors this show and makes it all possible. If you want to have a look at what we're doing as a magazine, why not head to premierchristianity.com? And while you're there, you can even pick up a free sample copy of our latest issue. That's premierchristianity.com. Time now, though, to rejoin my conversation with Tim Jupp, former keyboard player in Delirious and now the founder and pioneer of the Big Church Day Out.
You know, you referenced that thing, I said, where it feels like the conversation's getting louder. I mean, for example, you know, some of my connections even with the Catholic Church, and we've seen quite a lot of the Catholic community come to Big Church Day Out now, which is really exciting. And we've made some good friends with that community. And I know we're having conversations with them that probably weren't possible 30 or 40 years ago, where in the evangelical world, I think it would have been a far more difficult thing to do that.
So what's changed? If it was hard 30 years ago and it's easier now, what's happened?
I don't know. I mean, I guess ultimately you have to put it down to, you know, a move of the Spirit of God, I think. You know, I think, you know, I always say about Big Church that we're not a movement or anything like that. you can't join what we're doing, because in my mind there is only one movement, and that's the church. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so broad in its expression. I think one of the things I learned in Delirious, like I said before, is that we got an opportunity to be invited, engaged with a huge spectrum of expression of church across the world. And I think you get to learn pretty quickly that you can't say, well, this person's right and that person's wrong. They've got the whole thing going on. I mean, I can, you know, I'm not a theologian by any means, and I can only talk out of my own experience, but I remember once sitting down with a national leader in the UK of a denominational group, and we talked about the connection that our event has with the Catholic community. Now, I can't explain all that. I know there's different theology on some things, but I also know I have some great friends. I have an amazing personal relationship with Jesus who would call themselves Catholic, for example. And I can remember times like we went to India many times with a band and going to some of the darkest corners of the earth, where you're in these slum areas and meeting like a tiny community of Catholic nuns, these little old ladies. And, you know, so I was brought up as a good Baptist boy. So maybe with our theology, we'd never quite land on the same page, mm-hmm. as everything. But then when you ask these ladies why they're doing what they're doing, and you look at them in the eye, they say, well, we fell in love with Jesus, and he's called us to serve the poor, and that's why we're living in this place, mm. you know, to follow his call on our life. And yeah. I think, well, what do you do with that? Yeah. I mean, it's really, goodness me, we don't have all the answers, do we, do all this? And I think... Yeah. The important thing about unity, you know, I've been in some meetings where people still try and pursue unity by putting an agenda down which says, what are all the things that we can agree on? And I think sometimes maybe that's the wrong question. I feel like the question we should be asking more is, what are the things not that we can take hold of, but the things that we can let go of? For example, can we let go of the fact that maybe there's been times historically within the church where we've allowed our positions on things and our theology and whatever that is to polarize us relationally from other parts of the church who might have a different perspective on exactly the same thing. And what we do is we polarize ourselves, and sometimes we're even worse than that. We actually make ourselves right about those things, and we do that by maybe making them wrong about things. Mm. I think I just see the big church there almost like this big shared, you know, the old classic church picnic thing where we do our classic, you know, the church thing where everyone brings a thing and it's a share.
Bring and share.
Bring and share. That's the one, Sam. Bring and share, and you'll bring the quiche, and I'll bring
quiche, Christian quiche.
And I'll bring another quiche.
Has there ever been?
And there's a lot of quiche going on that's being shared. But what happens is we all share, and we share these different dishes. And I see big church out a bit like that. It's like we're it's just one huge picnic almost.
Yeah.
And there's a great Bible verse somewhere, and I can't remember where it is, about having picnics together. But that's not my entire theology for why we do what we do, by the way. But the picture of we've all got something to put on the table and something to bring.
We've all got different flavoured quiches.
We have.
Because there's no such thing as a Christian meeting that's ever taken place without some Christian quiche.
Yeah, you could have a bacon and cheese one, and I could have a broccoli one.
So let's get back to chatting about the music. And there's a great lineup, as always, big church out this year. Elevation, Hillsong, John Mark McMillan, they're all playing. I mentioned those three because they're all some of the headliners of the event, and they're all American, of course, or at least not from the UK. And I know you've said before that in the future you'd love to kind of raise up more, or, you know, help raise up more kind of UK-based artists. And of course, there are plenty of UK-based artists on the bill as well. But nevertheless, it does seem to be not just at Big Church Day Out, but arguably a lot of the kind of worship music that people in this country are consuming, it tends to be coming from other parts of the world. And I'd love to get your thoughts on this, because, and this isn't just a Delirious thing, but you don't have to go back too far to say, okay, it wasn't just Martin Smith, it wasn't just you know, it was Matt Redman as well, or it was Tim Hughes, and of course those guys are still making music. But there was a moment, wasn't there, in worship music where it was very UK based. You know, all the big songs that were going around the world, a huge amount of it was coming out from the UK. And I'm not saying that doesn't happen anymore, but it has been interesting in recent years. The shift seems to be moving more internationally, and there tends to be some very big names from America that, you know, you're bringing into the festival. So what's your thoughts on all of that? And do you still kind of want to see it almost return to the UK?
Well, I hold that lightly. I think your observations, I would agree with them entirely, but I think maybe it's just a seasonal thing, and I think things move in seasons. And I agree with you, Sam, that I think if you look at it a bit like, I mean, back in the day when we were first going to America, I would say it was a bit of a tide of English worship, and it did have, you know, in terms of those were some of the big songs that people sing around the world, that was true, and it was also true that it actually impacted a lot of what's coming out of America now. So it's amazing, even for an old guy like me now, you know, a lot of these bands we bring over from America, they're like, well, we're only doing what we're doing because of what you guys did. So there's that kind of honouring thing. And I think it's a bit like a tide. I almost feel like the wave went to America and then now the wave's coming back here right now. And I think there'll come a time when the wave goes back again. And that kind of thing. I think we've just got to all keep going and do what we do. I mean, sometimes there is a frustration in the kind of natural sense of the disadvantage of, oh, I'd love to have the resource to really get behind and see the UK guys develop more and make great records and be able to do this for a living and not have to go out and, you know, do the day job because they could really focus on their calling because there's not sort of an economy here which can sustain them. So that's a really challenging thing, and I think what you're seeing a lot in America, the swell at the minute with the music, it's coming out of big churches. So like the big churches have become the record labels, basically. You know, they have the resources to create the record, they have, you know, enough backroom staff to promote it, and they have a platform to sell it to through their own church and through their networks. That kind of thing, and get the song sung.
Yeah, I think all of what you've just said leads to a question that many people have, which is are we talking about a worship community, or are we talking about a worship industry? Is there some grey in all of that? Because there is that criticism, isn't there, sometimes when people are saying it's all just a kind of business, it's all a money-making thing. You must have heard that before. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, you get that all the time, but I think at the end of the day, you know, it comes down a lot, if we're talking about musical worship, it does come down to the songs. There's not a lot of rocket science in it. And if you take the industry argument away and you take all those other things away, actually great songs are great songs, and they'll travel and have a life of their own. So in some ways, it's difficult when we don't have an industry and a way to support it. In other ways, we have the internet, which is accessible to the whole world all the time. And I think great songs will get out there. So I think our job is to see creativity released and stuff. And, you know, I have a heart for that. And I'm working closely. I have a lot of friends in the UK who are trying to do stuff. You know, I'm working with a band at the minute called King's Village from down our way. I think they're probably one of, by a country mile, the leading worship bands in the UK right now. But they're still... it's still a hard journey. And they're at the beginning of a journey, and they can't do what these big American churches can do, but they're writing some really amazing songs. You know, and I think in the same way, you know, we have a different, slightly different expression sometimes and of church here in the UK, maybe to the US. So I think we've definitely got stuff to offer, particularly if, you know, some of those worship songs need to come out of our life of local church and what we see God doing in our communities. So I don't think it's dead and buried by any means. I think, you know, we'll see that come that way.
There's some exciting future developments. I want to come on and talk a bit about the youth element of what Big Church Doubt is going to be doing in the future, which is very exciting. Before we get there, though, we've got to talk about the highs and the lows, unfortunately. And, you know, we should comment on what happened with the North, with Big Church Doubt North. Now, I know this was you were really, really keen to say, you know, Big Church Doubt, it's happened historically, as you say, in Sussex. You mentioned the incredible Whiston estate, and I am one of the privileged people who has spent just a little bit of time inside that incredible I don't know what you call it, manor house, I suppose.
Yeah, Americans think it's a castle.
They think it's a castle.
We can let them think that if they like to.
We
call it a country pad.
It's not far off a castle, in my humble opinion. And, you know, this incredible thing that's happened in Sussex. But, of course, people have looked at it in the past and they've said, oh, but that's all the way down in Sussex and I'm living somewhere further north. And so you've tried really, I think more than once, arguably, to try and put something on in the north and replicate what you're doing. And so you'd have a system where, you know, a band would play on a Saturday in Sussex, and then they go up on the Sunday and they do Big Church Day out north. And to cut, I guess, a bit of a long story short, it hasn't been financially viable for you. But I'd like to hear a bit more of that kind of journey of, it must have been quite painful, I guess, to want to put something on and just not make it work economically was fundamentally what it came down to, wasn't it?
Yeah, it did come down to that. I mean, what we're doing, even in the Big Church Day out in the south, we've talked about that story, and you know, we are there because it was a good story, and we are there because of that, and that's what happened, and God did something. So we, you know, had I had that same conversation with somebody in the Midlands or somewhere else, I'm sure I'd have listened to what God was doing, but it just happened to be on this amazing estate with a family who had a heart to give up these acres of land to see the church gather.
Yeah.
And so we kind of went with what God did.
Yeah.
And so that's why we're there. And, you know, we're aware of people who have been travelling from all over the UK.
Even further afield, I hear Europe, some people are coming from.
There's a lot of groups like this. We've got a lot of groups set up from Holland and Belgium, some from France. I saw one from Switzerland the other day. So people travelling from all over. We've got people coming down from Scotland, they'll fly down, that kind of thing. And we're getting quite a contingency from the northwest. And you have to understand the economics of what we do makes absolutely no sense. If it did make sense and you made money at it, someone else would have done it years ago, I tell you. So, you know, it's no surprise in some ways we're the only people doing what we do on the scale that we do it.
Right.
And we're still hugely donor funded in the south.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't work. You have to sell tickets at, you know, three times the price. You'd have to sell copious amounts of alcohol and food. You'd have to be sponsored by, you know, Vodafone or Barclaycard or big high street brands to make, that's how that works in what we're doing.
Yeah.
And so there's some stuff that we just can't fix.
Yeah.
And we make that work because people have been incredibly generous about a vision.
Yeah.
Of both unity and seeing people saved.
I think it's really helpful to hear that, though, because sometimes you do hear people kind of complaining that, you know, a ticket to Big Church Day out, it's in the region of about £50 for a day. But sometimes you do hear, I think especially it's in the Christian world, it seems to be of, that's a lot of money. And you think, well, if this was a mainstream equivalent, it would, as you say, it'd be three times that amount. But I think it's helpful for people to hear the reason the economics don't work. Or, for example, at a Christian event, you don't sell a lot of alcohol. Or, for example, at Big Church Day Out, you let people bring their own food in, which a lot of other events wouldn't do. So I think it's helpful to hear those reasons.
A lot of other events, you wouldn't be allowed to take food on. Now, if we said to the church crowd, you can't bring your own picnic, they wouldn't come.
Yes, because of the quiche.
Yes. But then we don't have the income from that either. And, you know, we sell food and it's great and it's fantastic, but not on the level.
Yeah.
You know, and I talked to a guy the other day who was running a mainstream event, and he was selling a ticket for £35 to his event for one day. And I said, what do you project on your income from alcohol? He said, from the day, he said, oh, exactly the same as the ticket. Will I do an average income of £35 just on alcohol sales? Whereas we might do an average income of £2 or £3 a head on coffee. Do you know, so these things don't quite stack up and add up that way.
Yeah. I can believe that.
And, you know, and our heart is to make it as affordable as we can.
Yes.
We generally do.
Yeah.
And that is because we wanted to make it as inclusive as we can. But there's a kind of point where, you know, I think we all need to take, if we want to see this happen, we all need to take responsibility for that. And we've got some generous people who chip in and they take their part of their responsibility.
And just sticking with the main event that you're doing, you know, Big Church Day Out South, or which is the only Big Church Day Out that's currently running, just sticking with that, what have the numbers been in terms of growth? Because, I mean, as I mentioned, I was there at the first one, and from going back year on year, it seems like there has been quite significant growth. Are you at capacity for that site, or is there still lots more room for people to bring their friends?
No, the amazing thing is it's grown every single year. We're 13,000 the first year, and it's grown year on year. slowly and steadily. And this year we're up quite a lot from last year,
wow,
which is really exciting. The exciting thing on the venue down there is actually two of the tenant farmers, one either side of the land that we currently use, are no longer there, and the and a whole load of land has returned to the control of the estate.
Wow.
And we've got the opportunity to really grow that site. We could get 40,000 or 50,000 on there now.
Wouldn't that be incredible?
We're in a real trajectory, yeah, of how do we see that,
yeah,
happen in the next few years. You did ask the question about the north.
Yeah.
And the north was just really tough.
Yeah.
A big church day, as I've explained, is an incredibly expensive event to put on. We put a lot of work in, and we did, you know, we sold 20,000 tickets on touring dates in the few years before, within a 2-hour drive of that site. But when it came to do the event, we couldn't get all the people from a 2-hour radius to travel that far. So that's fine, and we know how these things work. We know these things take a lot of time to build. Where it kind of really got a bit scary for us is that in the second year we had 400 less people than the first year, and for us, so it wasn't ultimately actually about the money or the numbers, it was about the fact that it didn't grow. And we felt that if we'd done a third year and we'd gone down in numbers again and not grown again, probably all of Big Church Doubt would have fallen over. That was where we were at. You know, we would have bankrupted the whole thing.
Yeah. That must weigh quite heavily on you personally. It must be quite a weight to carry.
I think it's a weight to carry, but you have to hold everything lightly, don't you, in this thing? I think the important thing is that we wake up every day knowing that we, you know, the aim for the day is to do the best we can with what God's put in our hands. And I think we're doing that. And I think, you know, this is where you refer back to the band thing. You know, we can't find our identity and our significance in the things that we do. And at the end of the day, there's a bit of a paradox here with me, because I'm now leading what's the largest Christian event annually in the UK, and in a funny sort of way, I don't care for events. I'm a local church guy,
right,
through and through. Yeah. My heart is for local church.
Yeah.
But because I think, you know, events come and go and have seasons, and the great thing is the church is going nowhere. So long after Big Church Day Out is finished, and one day it will come to an end, it could be another 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, who knows. But the church is going nowhere, and the church is here to stay. So why we've got that kind of premise for it all, the exciting thing is Big Church Day Out could be a lot of fun, because we don't hang our hopes on that. But in the meantime, God can use that,
yeah,
and we're seeing lots of people become Christians at it.
Yeah.
It can be part of what helps to tell a story of unity in the UK and what God's doing, yeah, there. And that's really exciting, and we're going to love every minute of it.
So tell us about this youth project. BC Youth, I believe you're calling it.
Yep. So everybody will know nationally, you know, we don't have to say any more about what an enormous impact Soul Survivor has had for so many years. And no less true for myself personally, on my own level. I mean, Delirious were there for many years.
Yeah.
We used to play in the early years, go along and be guests of the event. And then my own kids went to the event for many years, and so I've got, you know, the fondest relationship with that event. It's been absolutely amazing. But similarly, going back to our roots, you know, we were involved in youth worship back in the 90s. We're now seeing, even in our local church, a whole new generation of young leaders come through, and God's given us a big event which can be used as a platform. So we're really excited to be able to create an offer as an option. And I know there's several things going on out there, and I think that's really exciting, because I think the variety,
yeah,
and diversity will only ever be a healthy thing.
Well, the way Mike Pilavachi's put it is, he's aware, obviously, Soul Survivor was so huge, there's actually no one event that can take that many kids, but he's spoken about 4, 5, or 6 kind of new events rising up, and if everyone takes a few thousand, then they can effectively, I guess, replace what Soul Survivor was doing in caring for young people. I mean, Mike has spoken specifically about he will actually want to endorse certain events from the platform at Soul Survivor. So is that something you're kind of hoping for, that there'll be a bit of a, you know, Mike giving you the official, yeah, thumbs up, so to speak?
I'll no idea if Mike has any intention of doing that, but I think we're going to go with what we feel God's asking us to do. I think the fact we have a real, the roots and the foundations of Big Church that come out of local church. Mm. So we're not an events company, essentially. Mm. We are local church people running a huge event. But the advantage of that is we have an events team which can deliver something amazing, you know, for young people. Yeah. And we're going to add on some morning program on the Saturday and the Sunday and the bank holiday Monday around Big Church Youth.
Right.
Called BC Youth around the Big Church Day Out, where we will have some teaching, some worship ministry. You know, want some really to see God really bust into the lives of young people and real genuine encounter with Jesus and the Holy Spirit. I think what's interesting about us is even with Soul Survivor, we're probably one of the most similar events where, you know, the three pillars of what we kind of sit on would be the same as Soul Survivor, which would be, you know, inclusivity to everybody. I think that's where Big Church Day is unique, because it's not a tribal event, and we're seeing every expression of church coming. And then it's the whole evangelistic thing. It's a space where people can bring their friends. And it's, you know, thirdly, we love the work of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
And that's who we are as people. And we're just excited to see what God does. Now, our event will be in May. Some people will want a youth event in the summer, so they'll do that. And I just think we're just creating an option and a possibility, which we think will be really exciting. But, you know, I think what people forget about Big Church Day Out is probably after Soul Survivor, we're probably the largest national event with young people at.
Right.
But because we're not known as a youth event, we've already got thousands and thousands of young people come to Big Church Day Out. And it's just a very natural next step for us.
I won't name names because it'd be unfair, but you know, I can think of another Christian event that's kind of based around music that's been running for a very, very long time that is not hitting the kind of numbers you are. And bearing in mind, you've only been around, is it 11 years?
Yes, our 10th year this year.
10th year, sorry. Yeah. So
our 11th event.
11th event, 10th year. So bearing in mind that, you know, again, compared to some other events, you're actually quite young. You have grown incredibly quickly. Now, other than the answer of God blessing it, what do you attribute that to?
Yeah, well if you want to take the God, I mean, I feel like...
you want to bring it back in, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, it has to be about that. There isn't, you know, there is strategy around what we're doing.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm asking.
You know, we're not in the summer, and the summer's a crowded space for all Christian events. We're in May, so we attract people from... We have people who go to all these other summer events. The festivals, the Bible weeks... all the denominational groups come to our event in May and also then go to their thing in the summer.
Right.
So it's accessible to everyone.
Yeah.
It's short. It's a 2-day thing. So even if you don't like camping, either you don't have to camp or you can camp and do it for a night or two and get away with it. We're probably the cheapest event out there. If you look at what people pay to come to our event, you know, per day, by a country mile in some respects. Yeah. So I think, and I think our heart is just to be inclusive. So in terms of being accessible to a very broad expression of both age and churchmanship, that's, you know, all those things combined, plus I like to think it's brilliant. Well, you know, the content's amazing.
I'm an impartial journalist. I can never say what I personally think of the event, but it doesn't take a genius to read between the lines and figure out what I personally feel of it. But hey, we're not here to talk about my feelings on Big Church Day Out.
That's all right. You go ahead.
I would love to know, given that you are a musician, given your history, your heritage and Delirious, how much personal say you have in who you want to book?
I have a lot of say.
You have a lot of say.
Well, I have a lot of say in who we invite.
Who you invite.
We have to get this different.
Okay.
Because people always say to you, why don't you book this person, book this person? And I think if you knew the half of what goes on, you know, we're already talking to people about 2021 and you start those conversations early.
Wow.
And I will have this A-list every year.
Yeah.
And it'll always end up looking completely different. So you have to bear in mind, and because I understand from the other side as well. When we were in Delirious, we were getting 500 or 600 invitations from all over the world every year, and we could probably commit to 100 of them. So which ones do you take? So we're up against that with all, isn't it, you know, just because we're a big event, it doesn't mean that they're not getting other invitations all over the world to other big events. So there's that, there's the relational side. And it's not like you've got a Chinese menu where you can go down and just tick off all the ones you want and then they'll come.
Yeah.
It just does not work like that. So yeah. I have to say, I'm excited that God's been faithful to that, and every year yeah. it's ended up amazing. And you know what's exciting now is sometimes people say, I'm not coming because the lineup's good, not very good. And I'm thinking, well, you're probably the wrong person to come to our event in the first place, because we're not about lineup. We're about creating a space for the church to come together, but we want it to be brilliant. And every year it is going to be absolutely brilliant, I promise you. But it might be brilliant sometimes with people you've never heard of. Mm. And sometimes we're booking actually artists that are very well known in different spheres yeah. or in different countries.
Yeah.
And people think, well, I've never heard of them. I'm yeah. thinking, well, you probably not really know what's going on then.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing. So I think this year's going to be unbelievable. I mean, even like having Snatch there and Ty Tribbett. You know, because they're gospel artists, a lot of people who are into gospel music think, well, I've never heard of them. And I'm thinking, well, what, we've got Ty Tribbett at our event. What an amazing thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, probably one of the only events in Europe that's got this incredible gospel artist yeah. this year. It's yeah. going to be incredible.
And it is brilliant. And I guess, but it also highlights a sadness that a lot of people feel. And I wonder if you share this. It highlights a sadness that the church in this country is sometimes divided down racial lines. And so you might have a black majority church who know exactly who those two artists are, but you might have a white majority church who've never heard of them. And there is a sadness for some people saying, isn't it a shame that we're not almost, that there's a sort of divide down racial lines, divide down musical lines, and you've got half the church listening to this worship leader and the other half the church listening to this gospel artist. And I suppose one of the things about Big Church Day Out is you're deliberately, I suppose, booking from both sides of that, if you like, and trying to bring everyone together.
Yeah, I think this is the paradox. This is what we hold in tension all the time. There's two things. Is that we want to, in some way, demonstrate unity.
Mm.
And that is, we do that in our way. The way we do that is say, we're going to create a space, everybody can come.
Mm.
That's how, and then we're in a field together. And then we can walk around this field for 2 days looking at people from all different diverse parts of the church and knowing it's okay and yeah. smiling at each other.
Yeah.
So we demonstrate unity. Mm. And then the other side of the paradox is we celebrate the diversity.
Right.
So it's all those things.
Yeah.
Because we're all different. We're always yeah. going to be different. And it's a cultural thing. And, you know, we like all sorts of music. People like, and God's made us all different, hasn't he? Mm. I mean, you know, he's not made us all the same.
Yeah.
And there's always going to be people like this sort of music or that sort of music.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not about the gospel or music or the other sort of music. I know we've got choirs, we've got orchestras. Like, some people don't like classical music, you yeah. know. And this year I've got an orchestra doing worship in our worship team.
Yes. Well, it's, I guess, like, that's another thing worth mentioning, that there are different stages, different venues. So if you want more of a,
yeah, it's not a youth event, it's not for young people, yeah, it's for the church.
Yeah.
And the church is all ages.
Well, I mean, there's only one act. I mean, you mentioned some amazing acts that are playing this year. You mentioned Snatch, we've talked about Elevation Worship and Hillsong, and there's obviously only one act that's really missing that we need to book for. I mean, you need to book for 2020 2021. I mean, you're nodding your head, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And it's the question you must get all the time, and I bet you're sick and tired of hearing it, but it would be wrong for me to conduct this interview and not ask it. When are Delirious going to get back together and headline Big Church Out again?
My answer is, you're asking the wrong person. How do I know?
Well, you can't,
who knows?
You can't blame
it's
me
a
for
million
trying
dollar
to.
Question, isn't it?
You can't
if
blame
I knew the
me
answer
trying.
To that.
They might do it for free, though. I mean, you know, you never know.
Yeah. I don't think it's ever about the money, though. I think it's whether they do it or not.
They're tough to book, for sure. Yeah. Okay, well, Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in and chatting about all things Delirious and the Big Church Day Out. And keep up the awesome work.
Loved it. Thank you, Sam.
You're listening to Premier Christian Radio. That was my interview with Tim Jupp, the founder of the Big Church Day Out. If you want to find out more about all things Big Church Day Out, just go to their website, which is bigchurchdayout.com. You can get tickets, find out about the lineup, everything you need to know. It's all at bigchurchdayout.com. And during that interview, we obviously talked about the days of Delirious. That's the band that Tim Jupp played keyboards in. And it was fronted by Martin Smith. If you want to hear my interview with Martin Smith, that's available on the Profile podcast. More and more people are choosing to access this show as a podcast. That means that you can get it direct to your phone, your tablet, or wherever you like to access podcasts. If you want to check out the Profile podcast, just go to premierchristianradio.com. patreon.com/theprofile, or search for The Profile wherever you normally get your podcast from, and you will find my interview with Martin Smith and many other people. Over 100 people now have been interviewed on The Profile podcast. We are sadly out of time, but thanks so much for joining me for this past hour to hear my interview with Tim Jupp. I do hope you enjoyed it, and we will see you next time.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have Leaf Filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A Leaf Filter Trusted Pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install Leaf Filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, Leaf Filter Trusted Pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.